Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:16 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is October 28th, and I'm today being Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I'm recording a little early today because I'm heading off to the airport, to go to the World Money Show in Orlando for the weekend, and I'll be speaking on Sunday. So if any subscribers are around, I'm happy to say hello. Well, I thought we'd kick off this week with just a graphic representation of just how much interest rates have been going up, not simply in one country, but everywhere this year. So in September, there were 35 interest rate hikes alone, 19 in October, and this is significantly more than we saw, for example, in the hiking cycle ahead of the global financial crisis in 2007 and 8. So central banks are trying to normalize policy. They're trying to get inflation under control. But we're talking about a swell of cash that has entered the market. And large numbers of people have gone to cash. So there's a lot of cash sitting on the sidelines right now. And that's obviously being eroded by inflation, but losing at, or perhaps that is more likely to have been now invested in short-dated government paper. So people are making 4% guaranteed rather than losing 30% on the Nasdaq or about 11% on the Dow Jones as of yesterday. Of course, inflation does eat into that, but not nearly to the same extent. At least you don't see the total going down in real time. Now, when we think then about yield curves, well, we know that there are yield curve inversions, but this is another way of looking at it. You look at the number of different permutations for the yield curve that are inverted. So we certainly know, for example, that the 10-year minus the 2-year has been inverted for quite some time already, and that the 10-year minus the 3-month became inverted this week. But usually, by the time a recession starts, the vast majority of the entire yield curve has inverted. Now, we are approaching a point now where about 65% of the different permutations are inverted. Prior to the financial crisis in 2007 and 8, it was up to about 70%, and in 2000 it was in excess of 90%. So we're certainly in an environment where liquidity conditions are tightening. There's absolutely no getting around that fact. So I think that's an important consideration. Now, I thought that the upper dynamic on Gilead this week was really impressive, and I'll come back to that sector in a moment. But let's first look at the 10-year minus the 3-month, because it was held out by the Federal Reserve as the example of how liquidity conditions had not become too tight. And that was back in March when it was at 225 basis points. Well, now it's negative 4. So we've had this incredibly swift contraction. And if we just zoom out and look at what this means, well, one thing is for certain, that on this occasion, the expansion of the yield curve did not get up to the upper side of the range. And you might say, well, how could it possibly have? Because we've had this very low interest rate environment. So they couldn't cut interest rates beyond zero and therefore could not achieve a spread of about 350 basis points. But what that also implies is that it takes less time to expand, less time to contract, and therefore we have a shorter cycle. And we've had a recession in 2020, and now we're going to have another recession in 2023. So I think this is something that we have to bear in mind. But One thing that's important to pay attention to is that right after the yield curve inverts, and it doesn't really matter whether you look at the 10-year minus the 3-month or at the 10-year minus the 2-year, right after the inversion, stocks often go up, but that rally is usually the last hurrah. Because what happens is the yield curve spread inversion is representative of tightening liquidity, but it takes time to show up in corporate profits. So the 10-year minus the 2-year inverted about 3 or 4 months ago. Now we're starting to see earnings rolling over. Meta had a really disastrous earnings announcement in here this week from the perspective of investors. It's not like they've stopped making money, but rather they are not cutting expenses nearly as quickly as investors might like. So the share was down exceptionally heavily, but the valuation is much improved. So I think that's also important to highlight that valuations have certainly been doing better over the course of the last few months. Now, when we think about what that means, well, does that mean that Meta is now a value play and it's going to start garnering support and will go up 4 times to exceed the peak in 2021? I think that's rather unlikely. The go-go years of social media expansion are pretty much over. And they're trying to develop the metaverse, and it's not going nearly as quickly or as well as they might like. And there's been a lot of faffing around trying to figure out how to put legs on characters within the metaverse, and that is costing a fortune for limited benefit. So the share was a little steadier in here today, and it is very oversold. I mean, Meta could almost double and still only unwind the oversold condition relative to the 200-day moving average. We've continued to see downward pressure on Google because advertising revenue is becoming much more competitive, but it is at least pausing here in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Amazon yesterday is still growing its cloud business, but not as quickly as it has in the past. And the retail sector is probably going to experience one of the least enjoyable holiday seasons of recent years. So Amazon is back testing the $100 area, and it collapsed in trading overnight, then opened below 100, is now above 100, oversold in the short term. What I think is relevant here is that it does have a PE, does not have an estimated PE for the end of this year. So it's still trading though at a rich valuation of 87 times. Now, when we think about Apple, I think Apple is a very interesting case here. The share was up $11 in here today. That is despite the fact that iPhone sales are disappointing and services growth is ebbing. And the company gave up giving guidance about 2 quarters ago. But because the results were not disastrous, then the share has been rewarded. And in many respects, it's because it's like the last man standing. So if you're going to buy something, well, then you buy something that has had reasonable earnings and is showing at least some evidence of being able to weather the current tightening conditions. But the reality is that Apple does not, the CFO was very clear in stating that they don't anticipate sales recovering in this, and of course, Apple, this is going to be quarter one for Apple because their fourth quarter just ended, so they tend to count their year different to everyone else as well. I would be incredibly surprised if Apple were to push on to new all-time highs. I regard this rebound as temporary in nature. But so far, we have not yet seen a willingness to short the largest company in the world, or at least not particularly successfully. Now, when I would be willing to buy more puts if this thing goes up any further, or most particularly if it were to get all the way back up into the August peak, I think I would be buying more puts. But when we think about the environment overall, one thing that was also notable in here this week was that the PMI came in below 50. And it, I'm sorry, that is, the survey says for 50. I'm almost positive I saw something that said it was below 50. It's a necessary condition for a recession that the manufacturing sector be rolling over. We've also seen that awareness of the inflationary problem is turning up everywhere. So I've seen lots of examples of shrinkflation, where the insides of jars are being hollowed out. The ice cream is being put inside a bigger cup to shield it. The Godiva is hollow in the middle. So we've had lots of these kinds of examples. But the reality here is that inflation is still problematic. GDP growth in the third quarter was positive and slightly better than anticipated, but inflationary pressures are broad-based. Germany's inflation rate came through at 11.6% in here today. So the ECB raised rates in here today, or in here this week, I should say. And then it was not a it wasn't a unanimous decision. And now inflation in Germany is ramping higher. So the bigger question is, will the ECB be willing to continue to raise rates? The big challenge is that a lot of the inflation that we see in Europe is supply driven because of the energy crisis, and a lot of the inflation that we see in the USA is demand driven. Now, of course, there are supply and demand factors contributing to inflation in both jurisdictions, but the weighting of one to the other is different. So the Federal Reserve is in a stronger position to raise interest rates because most of the inflation is supply driven, excuse me, is demand driven. And raising interest rates is a solution for a demand environment. Now, excuse me, I need to sneeze. So, when we think about where is the euro going, it's right here in the region of parity. It rallied on Wednesday to break the sequence of lower rally highs, but it has not followed through on the upside. And this isn't enough to break the downtrend overall. When there's so much at stake, and where there's a lot of trading around this question, and there's an acute willingness to buy the dip, well, then you're going to see trading around these big round numbers. But what people are really trading at essence is that there's going to be a pivot by the Fed. And the pivot is being anticipated that instead of raising by 75 basis points continually, that they'll move to 50, then immediately after 25, and then they'll hold rates for a while, which is what they did in 2019. It's what they also did in 2007. They hold rates, and on that occasion, it was for about 9 months, and then they cut them. So, usually the bond market will anticipate that pivot, and bond yields generally peak before the Fed pivot. So The 10-year yield paused this week and then rebounded today. It's up 10 basis points, back above the 4% level. So we did have a little dip into the underlying range. A midpoint danger line stop was not triggered. So this is still a reasonably consistent uptrend. And if we get upside follow through next week, well, then that's going to be pricing in more interest rate hikes. And the reality is that inflationary pressures are still with us. So the dollar index is also still trending higher. And we did have a dip below 100, and then it rebounded yesterday, and then improved upon that performance in here today. So this is still a reasonably consistent uptrend. Now, we've had three downside key reversals in the space of a month, and a very mild sequence of lower rally highs, but not much in the way of downward follow through, and not really very dynamic moves either. So we're going to have to see more than that to really suggest that the dollar's period of outperformance is over. And gold had rebounded in a reasonably impressive fashion over the course of the last 2 weeks, but it's down $21 in here today. So it really does need the weakness of the dollar to support the argument for investing in gold from the perspective of many investors. Now, one thing I continue to see is speculation about the shortage of gold coins, the shortage of silver coins in particular. Well, and there are instances where the price of silver coins on eBay is double the price of spot. But the price is not rebounding. So the reality is that there's no shortage of silver, and there's silver being delivered to the fabricators for bars and for coins, the mints. But the mints don't have excess manufacturing capacity, so they're not able to meet demand, not because of a lack of silver, but because of a lack of manufacturing capacity. So that's inflating the physical price of gold and silver, but not inflating the futures price. So what we really do need to see is dollar weakness and a Fed pivot. The some of the clearest arguments for gold are that you get negative real interest rates. Well, we have negative real interest rates. Inflation is running at 8%, interest rates are less than 4%. That's a very deep negative real interest rate environment. But it is contracting. Now, if we look at constant maturity index or for the real yield, I'm going to just read it. It's the Federal Reserve U.S. Treasury constant maturity 10-year real yield curve rate, and it's jumped from -1% at the beginning of the year to positive 1.6%. So even though we have in absolute terms negative real interest rates, the reality is that constant maturities are looking at a positive real interest rate, and that is weighing on gold. Now, when the Federal Reserve does pivot, and they will pivot, then we're likely to see gold recover and make up all of its losses in a short period of time. But that doesn't mean that we can't have downward pressure first. And the potential for the dollar to continue to rebound because we do have inflationary pressures. Now, the other point, of course, is that central banks have mandates. And those mandates, in many times, they tend to be ignored. But in times of duress, they are followed. So, the Federal Reserve has two mandates. The first is to pursue maximum employment. So, if we just simply think about the unemployment rate, it's 3.57%. And that is pretty close to all-time lows. Now, is it going to rise in future? Yes. But is it urgent that they do something to control unemployment right now? No. So the Federal Reserve has ample room in which to continue to raise interest rates. Then there's the second one, which is they need to have stable prices. Well, they don't have stable prices, and inflation is seriously problematic. So they have to do something to try and curtail speculative activity. Well, with so much liquidity in the markets, then what we have really is a Fed call. Whereas we had the Greenspan put, the Yellen put, the Bernanke put, and now we had the Powell put for a while, but now we have the Powell call. So every time stock markets rally and asset prices inflate, then that only increases the potential that the Federal Reserve will continue to raise rates. So when we look at the Nasdaq, it's rebounding from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and certainly was led higher today by Apple. So this is we had the upside Q reversal 2 weeks ago, and the price was up in a reasonably dynamic manner in here today. The Dow Jones Industrials Average is right in the region of the 200-day moving average, and up 800 points in here today. So certainly we're seeing a lot more interest in at reliable dividend payers. If we just simply look at the biggest constituent movers, Intel and Apple have both rebounded quite emphatically. But then you also have Microsoft, Boeing, Nike, and McDonald's. Intel has been exceptionally oversold. And its earnings were negative yesterday, but the share is rebounding, and not least because they're cost cutting. So they had been saying they're going to spend a whole ton of money on building new semiconductor fabrication plants, and now they're going to try and limit the expense of that. But they're still generations behind their biggest competitors. So we're going to see some unwinding of the short-term oversold condition, but Intel has got an awfully long road in front of it. So we've certainly seen big moves on the downside, and some shares are very oversold. So they do have room in which to bounce, and those bounces could potentially be quite emphatic. But we're still in a tight liquidity environment. The biggest, I think, lesson from the last decade has been that the Nasdaq has bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average on successive occasions. And the last time that's even remotely similar to here was back in 2015 and 16. But even then, we had a higher reaction low, not a lower low. Every time the price came back to the region of the 1,000-day moving average, we had a new infusion of liquidity. And on this occasion, that's not happening. There's expectation for it. There is a willingness to buy the dip in advance of liquidity becoming more available. But if the Fed call attitude is correct, then it's unlikely that the rallies are going to last. And I think that that is, in fact, the Fed call is the name of the talk I'm giving at the World Money Show. So I don't think that these rallies are going to persist because we don't have the liquidity coming through. Now, let's think then if that is the case. Well, during a recession, we can anticipate that liquidity would become more available, but only in response to falling corporate profits and difficulties in the financial sector. And I do think that it is companies like Brookfield Asset Management are at the epicenter of risk. So the share was also in positive territory in here this week and bouncing from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But when I saw, for example, John Authors today using the Wile E. Coyote verbiage to talk about earnings. But I heard the exact same description of commercial property in San Francisco from another contact during this week as well, where the people on the ground are looking at vacant offices and workforces that have no intention of coming back to work in the office, and companies that are waiting for their leases to expire before they hand back the buildings. And where are they going to find new tenants? So these buildings are owned by pension funds, they're owned by private equity funds. And where are they going to find new tenants? This has been certainly a problematic event for the shopping mall owners over the course of the last decade, and it's likely to be a significant problem for the commercial side of the real estate sector on this occasion. So the work from home phenomenon is certainly something that's not going away. And there have been multiple surveys taken where people have said that they will not go back to the office and they would rather quit their job than go back. And forcing people to go back to the office just makes for an unhappy workforce. So there will obviously always be people who would prefer to work in an office, and there will be people that don't. And we're going to see a leveling out. And one of the, I think, the factors in the property price inflation that we had over the pandemic was in that leveling process, that higher paying jobs migrated from the coasts of the US into the center, raised prices in some areas, depressed them in others, and this leveling out is practically over. Now, some people will find they don't like where they've moved and they'll move back. Others will be moving there to experiment themselves. But asset prices are coming down, and property prices are coming down. Mortgage rates are at record levels relative to income and pricing. So there is plenty of scope for prices to come down. Now, when we think then about the stock market, well, the most overvalued portion of the market has become less overvalued. And we've certainly seen that that has been a factor in a willingness to buy the dip in here. Now, I think this was a good representation of that. That the FANG company's valuation has come in a lot over the course of the last year. So some companies like Amazon still have high valuations. Apple is still a high valuation, but Meta has come in. Netflix has come in. Now, the next, of course, big question is the company that everyone either has a visceral liking for or a visceral hatred for, which is Tesla. And the share is bouncing from the $200 area. And Elon Musk has just completed his sale of Twitter, or his purchase, excuse me, of Twitter. I saw a news story over the last couple of days talking about the fact that China has now, or excuse me, that Tesla has been waiting for this giant press to stamp out the Cybertruck, and it's on its way there. So they might actually start building those big trucks and start delivering on some of their promises. Now, of course, it's already nearly 3 years late, but That's not unusual for Tesla. Then the question is, are they going to be able to make those vehicles affordable? So lithium carbonate prices are at exceptionally high levels, up now to 564,000 renminbi per ton, and still rising. So there is an acute shortage of lithium. And we have companies like BMW getting ready to roll out an exceptionally expensive hybrid version of its X-Class M series SUV, and the share is rebounding. So they intend to continue to supply battery vehicles, and every one of them is intending to do that. So where are they going to get the resources? And how are people going to afford them? These are, I think, really significant questions. When the electric vehicle is selling for 80,000 and interest rates on loans are somewhere around 6 to 7%, then your repayment is going to be well in excess of $1,000 a month. So how are most ordinary people going to afford that when rent isn't generally more than about 2,000 a month? It just does not seem to make a lot of sense to me. But certainly these companies continue to remain profitable, but more importantly, their valuations are exceptionally low. So BMW has got a forward PE of 3.5 and yields 7%. So investors aren't going to be all that bothered by where they're going to get the lithium from if they're getting a dividend yield of 7% and the share is recovering. This is certainly being beneficial for the traditional automotive companies, where large numbers have really attractive PEs, and Volkswagen has got a PE of 3 and a yield of over 5%. So in an inflationary environment, then that's something that's likely to be rather beneficial. And we've definitely seen these companies pulling back in a violent manner. So the big question then is, how is Tesla going to compete with that? Are they going to continue to be the number one best-selling vehicle, particularly when all these other companies bring out their own versions of electric vehicles? So there's certainly a lot to play for, but at least the valuation supports the outlook for the automotive sector, at least the traditional portion of the automotive sector. As we look at what's likely over the next year and then what's likely afterwards, because I think there's no value to continually harp on about the risk of a recession without offering some form of solution. So I do think that the technology sector has reached its peak of growth in advertising and cloud. What we're now seeing is the big question of total addressable market. And when you're the first company in this in your sector, you have all of the market to yourself. So when Tesla started off making electric vehicles, well, they could look at the total market for vehicles in the world and say, that's our total addressable market, and we're the only people doing it, so that's how big our growth opportunity is. Well, when every other company in the world that's manufacturing vehicles decides to make electric vehicles, well, then the total addressable market is the same, but it has to be shared over a large number of other companies. And then let's think about advertising. Well, when Google started off selling advertising, they were the first of the online venues to sell advertising successfully. They created their ad engine. Then they could look at how big was advertising and think that that was their total addressable market and that it might even increase. And it did. The amount of money spent on advertising has ballooned over the course of the last decade. But today you have social media venues and you have Amazon selling advertising. So the number of companies trying to target that total addressable market continues to increase. So then let's think about the outlook for the cloud sector. Well, on the one hand, you have the data providers, so the data centers. So you've got Amazon, started off with AWS, they had it all to themselves, and then subsequently both Google and Microsoft got in on the act. Then you have a huge number of middle market software providers and consultants that provide services. So they're all now sharing in that total addressable market. And the pandemic accelerated lots and lots of sales from way out in the future. So we've had this huge contraction where the market has pulled back by 50% and fully unwound the overextension at following the peak in our pre-pandemic peak. And I think this is a logical area where we might start to see some support coming through. But it could be a while, and I think several years, before we see prices go back up to the peak, which would be a double from where prices are right now. And the companies in the middle market are probably going to be squeezed most. So now let's think about, well, what are the kinds of companies that will prosper in future? Well, we know that energy is going to be a hot button topic for the foreseeable future. Brent crude is in a very tight range. I've seen lots of people predicting that prices are going to rally in an exceptionally violent manner. And this suggests that there's going to be a huge energy crisis. Not so much that demand is going to suddenly surge, but that supply will be in no position to continue to keep up with it. Well, in order for that to happen, we would need to have a really significant accident. And most particularly, the US shale would need to peak. Now, I don't think we're yet at a point where that determination can be made. Instead, what I think is likely right now is that we're looking at a couple of years where there hasn't been any significant jump in investment in shale production. And it's a very capital intense business. So you have to put in a lot of money, you get your money back quickly, and those types of business model don't work unless you have high prices. And when prices start to come back down, then they become loss-making quite quickly. And a lot of those business models that worked for gathering cash didn't return favorably for investors. So not only is there ESG issues, but that there's also just profitability issues that are circling around the unconventional sector in the USA. That means that higher prices will be required to encourage new investment into the business. And that's creating a less liquid environment and a tighter market overall. Now, let's just think about the fact that there are many, the commodity prices are trading in backwardation, and oil is one of them. So this is supporting the view that there is a short-term supply deficit. And prices are in backwardation all the way out the curve. So that's rather bullish in the near term. But Against the bullish argument, you have the demand argument. And if we do have a recession, then demand is going to be hit. So I think that when we think about energy and resources, well, it's quite normal in or ahead of a recession that highly defensive sectors are the last ones to peak. So energy prices are still steady, and energy stocks are right in the region of their highs, and we're in positive territory again in here this week. The pharmaceutical sector has also been really quite firm, and I think healthcare is a rather special example because pharmaceutical companies can create something out of nothing, and they can meet the intractable problems of society and deliver solutions that improve productivity, and then that can have a really significant knock-on effect. So immuno-oncology is probably going to be the buzzword, a word of the next few years. And Gilead popping on the upside today with earnings improving, but most particularly the commercialization of CAR T-cell therapies, which is basically educating the immune system to target cancers, because cancer has got this uncanny ability to avoid detection by the immune system. So if they can re-educate these T-cells, then they can go off and kill cancer without any kind of surgery. And it does work, but they're difficult to manufacture. So it has slowed down the pace of commercialization. We've had big moves from immuno-oncology companies over the last decade. We had a huge move up in 2015, and then another big move higher in 2017 and 18, and then subsequently prices collapsed. Well, during the collapse, companies like Gilead and Bristol Myers Squibb, they moved in and bought some of the companies that were closer to commercialization. So Bristol Myers Squibb is bouncing from the region of the $70 area and the upper side of this 6-year range. And these companies are exhibiting really significant relative strength, and they've been going sideways for a prolonged period. And then when we think about the valuations, well, they're undemanding. So you've got an estimated PE of 10 and a dividend yield of 2 and a bit. So this is more attractive from a pure valuation perspective than the aggressive multiples that are still being attached to companies like Amazon, which where the PE is almost 100. So this obviously raises the question whether we're in a secular, or I guess a secular or a cyclical bull market, because the kinds of companies that are doing best are value companies. And we are definitely seeing that valuations are improving and dividend yields are rising. So the way that we've defined a secular bear market historically was a generational long process of rising dividend yields and valuation contraction. And against a background of inflationary pressures, then that's certainly something that's going to be a factor. So we're also seeing that the value sector is outperforming growth in a rather robust manner. Now, Apple's rebound in here today, notwithstanding, value continues to outperform growth. And then when we think about the performance of those eight FANG companies relative to the total market, well, it broke down this week. So we're seeing at a minimum a really significant rotation. Valuations have contracted in growth. But that does not mean that they're going to quickly regain their peaks. Rather, there is a much stronger likelihood that we're going to see a lengthy period of ranging. And I think Netflix was the one that pulled back first and bounced first, and now it's pausing in the region of the 200-day moving average. And it might even get back up to the 1,000-day moving average. But then it's likely that we move into a lengthy range. I think that has to be contrasted with the valuations on telecom companies. So AT&T has been trending downwards for years, but it's rebounded really emphatically over the last 2 weeks, and the PE is in single digits, and it's got a yield of 6%. So I don't think anyone is betting that it's suddenly going to become the Apple of the future. But people will take a 6% yield. Then let's just think about those yields. Well, the high yield spread has contracted over the balance of this week, and it's still holding around 500 basis points. We haven't yet seen the blowout. So usually you get a scare. You get companies that are starting to go bust because liquidity conditions are tightening up. Well, they haven't done that yet. So high yield spreads have risen, but they haven't got to 800 basis points, much less 1,000 basis points. And arguably, because interest rates are higher than a lot of high yield debt is already in double digits on yield or close to. So that might be attractive in the short term. And of course, that is assuming that the high in the nominal yield is approaching. But until unemployment rates start to rise, I don't think that that's likely. And I think it's also worth highlighting that the JOLTS index has peaked. But one thing that all that commentary we've seen over the last few years hasn't really talked about is that it's been trending higher for years now. So what's more accurate is we've had a really significant change in the makeup of the workforce. So lots of people retired during the pandemic and they're not coming back. And that's a significant loss in terms of the job market. Then the number of immigrants coming into the USA, for example, was in excess of 1 million people a year legally in 2016. And now it's less than 200,000. So you balance that out over the course of 5 or 6 years, and you're talking about millions of missing workers. So when you get this huge boost of liquidity into the market, then there's no one to take those jobs. And what the Fed needs to do is to raise rates enough that those jobs disappear. In other words, you need an economic contraction to rebalance the labor market because wage growth is going crazy. Now, when job openings roll over, that's usually the first signal. If you're a hiring manager, the first thing you're going to do is look for new workers. Then business starts to roll over or ease back. So you say, well, maybe we can get away with not hiring quite as many people. And then business gets worse, so you don't hire anybody, and those job openings disappear. And then people start resigning and you don't replace them. But then business gets worse and you don't have any choice, so you fire people. And there is a logical progression to all of that. And I think that is where we are in the cycle right now. So job openings are just beginning to roll over, but there is a sequence of events and we will get to higher unemployment. And it's when we get a jump in unemployment, that's when we can anticipate the Federal Reserve will stop raising interest rates. It's when the dollar will roll over, and then more speculative assets will gain more traction. So it's likely that because we have geopolitical tensions, and what's happening in China right now is, I think, most particularly important. And I've written a fair bit about it in here today, but the Hang Seng China Enterprises Index is accelerating lower, and it's just about everything. Now, valuations are getting really low. We see, for example, on Hutchison Group that the estimated PE is 4 and it yields 6. But the risk is that these types of companies run into significant trouble with China and its economic slowdown. It's very much my opinion that the lockdown and COVID zero is a lot less about the virus and much more about a managed decompression of the housing bubble. And housing prices are falling, liquidity conditions are tightening, and you're getting rolling lockdowns. So they're going to blame then any weakness in the property price or prices on the pandemic and continue to lock down to secure people's safety. But safety from what is probably a better question. Safety from the virus or safety from the government? That's, I think, a very much an open question. But prices are accelerating lower. There's the real possibility that China ends up in a recession. And then that's going to put downward pressure on commodity prices. And it would also put downward pressure on inflation. I think that copper is at a very interesting position right now. It looked encouraging on Wednesday, and then it was down 8 cents in here today. But most particularly, it is ranging below the 1,000-day moving average. What we've certainly seen this week is that mining companies are willing to now sign longer-dated contracts, which is basically hedging. So, mining companies engaging in hedges at these levels is really not a bad idea because we just do not know how deep a recession China is going to have. And most particularly, it's going to put especially big pressure on companies and countries that rely on China for demand. And that is most particularly true of Australia, where iron ore and coal exports are a significant part of the economy. Now, natural gas exports are starting to rise in importance for Australia, and the ASX 200 is hovering here between the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving averages. And it's quite likely to be in positive territory on Monday because it'll take its cue from Wall Street. But just because we have some short-term enthusiasm, it does not mean that we're going to see a return to a bullish environment immediately. I think that as we think about how this recession will evolve, the epicenter of risk is in the pensions, private equity funds, endowments, and financial engineering companies. So that's where we're going to see some of the heaviest burden fall. The opportunistic side of the equation is going to be in commodities because we're going to have more infrastructure development. National security is going to become a much more pressing factor in terms of energy and in terms of manufacturing going forward. There'll be a lot more nearshoring. That's going to benefit countries like Mexico, Indonesia, India, and Brazil. And we have the Brazilian election this weekend, and it's a very close race. But whoever wins is going to encourage, or excuse me, inherit an economy that has already broken in the back of inflation. So Brazil is likely to start to cut interest rates before everywhere else because inflationary pressures are moderating there. That's likely to also benefit the domestic financial sector. And Brazil will be in a preferable place relative to everywhere else. But then we can think about the healthcare sector. We have literally tens, if not hundreds of millions of people retiring over the next decade, all the way across North America and Europe, and Japan for that matter. Countries need to come up with a way to manage the cost of looking after those people. So, healthcare innovation is not just a nice to have, it's absolutely essential. And that continued outperformance in the healthcare sector, well, they are likely to wobble during a bear market or during a recession, but they will be among the first to rebound. The defensive sectors are doing best right now. And when the defensive sector does best, it's usually the last inning before a recession starts. So all of the factors that point to a recession are coming into focus, where we have inverted yield curves, rising high yield spreads, high energy prices, tightening liquidity conditions, and defensive sectors doing best. Then that's usually what happens before a recession. Recessions don't last indefinitely. There will be pivots. We will see interest rates cut. We will see yield curve spreads pushing higher again. That will create the liquidity conditions for a new bull market. But we're not there yet. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend and I'll wish all the best to all of you.